From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. We have another fantastic show ahead of us right now. We have Wendy Murphy. You know Wendy. She actually has a new blog, or at least it's the first time I've seen it. It's And Justice for Some. You'll know that as the title of her book, .blogspot.com. And she wrote an interesting article on there, Dead Wives Talking, of course, about Drew Peterson and the much-anticipated motion that Joel Brodsky brought forward about the hearsay law, and I thought I'd bring Wendy on to talk about it. Hi, Wendy.
Hey, Dana. Good to be with you. Thanks so much for having me again. Yeah, Dead Wives Talking. I was hoping that would provoke some interest because it's kind of a complicated issue, but the point is very simple. There are two, at least one we know is certainly dead, but the other likely dead, two wives who will, I think, be able to testify at Drew Peterson's trial in the death of his one of his wives, Kathleen Savio. And I believe that the words of both his still-missing wife, Stacey Peterson, and Kathleen Savio herself will come into evidence. And the good news is, and what I really want to emphasize for folks, so please let it be the first thing I say, and I hope I reiterate it at the end, is that women need to understand if they're living in violent homes and if they're being abused, if they're suffering in silence, that's not only bad for them in terms of their well-being, it's bad in the event they need access to justice, even should they end up dead at the hands of their abuser. So women, I think, need to understand the value of this hearsay testimony. If you're being battered, if you're being abused, please tell someone not only that you're suffering, that you're being abused by a particular man or woman. I mean, we know this can happen in other kinds of relationships, but tell somebody, put it in writing, record it, make a video statement. Do anything you can to put in writing not only what you're going through, but that you believe you may end up dead and be killed at the hands of your abuser for the purpose of making it impossible for you to testify against him. If women started to do that more, they would be able to testify even in the sad event of their untimely death.
You know, it's a huge part of this case, I believe, or the cases coming up. But a lot of people, Wendy, don't understand what hearsay, what that means, what it's all about. Let's try and explain that.
Yeah, let's go back to square one. And thanks so much for the chance. It is complicated. And, you know, I do so much TV where we only have a sound bite's worth of time to explain things. And this is one of those stories that needs a little bit more. So good for you, Dana. Thanks for letting me take some extra time. You know, there's something very basic about the point, which is this. Hearsay, generally speaking, is forbidden because the person giving the statement isn't in the courtroom to be cross-examined, and that's not fair to the accused.
Right.
Hearsay means, in a technical sense, statements that were made by someone who isn't around to testify about it. So it could be a statement from someone who's dead, or it could be someone who just isn't there. In the courtroom, they're either unavailable, they live someplace else, they've moved away, whatever. The hearsay can also be something like a statement in a medical record. There are all kinds of hearsay statements that come in even though the defendant can't cross-examine the person who made the statement, because there are lots of what we call exceptions to this rule against hearsay. So one of the most impressive exceptions historically has been the excited utterance rule, and in some cases also the rule that allows statements to come in if a person knows that they might soon die, the so-called dying declaration exception. But one of the least used exceptions is up front and center in this case, and it basically goes like this. If a person makes a statement about you, a statement that you are a killer, a statement that you've done something terrible, a statement that could help the prosecution put a defendant away for life or for any amount of time, a statement that could help the prosecution build its case. If somebody has a statement to offer, but they're not around to make it, if the prosecution nevertheless wants to use it, they can if, and this is the big news story about the hearsay in the Drew Peterson case, if the reason the person is unavailable to testify live in court so that Peterson's lawyer can cross-examine the person, the reason they're unavailable is because Peterson caused them to be unavailable. If that's the case, if a defendant on trial causes a witness to be unavailable, he waives his right to cross-examine them, and he can't complain that the hearsay is unfair because he has no chance to test their credibility in a court of law. This is the beauty of this case. We haven't talked about this much at all. And I got to tell you, when I was in law school, this issue never came up in my class on evidence. Right. Nobody ever said, you give up your right to cross-examine witnesses if you, the defendant on trial, cause a witness to become unavailable, which requires then that hearsay instead of live testimony be admitted against you. So it's this very old doctrine. It's called the forfeiture by wrongdoing rule. You forfeit your rights if by your wrongdoing you cause someone's unavailability. The court in the United States Supreme Court, in a couple of recent cases, Crawford and Giles among them, have reiterated the importance of this rule as they've taken on a kind of a global new look at what hearsay evidence is all about, whether it's good or bad, how to construct rules that are fair to the accused, and so forth. They literally reminded prosecutors a couple of years ago of this forfeiture rule, and so states around the country have started to use it, have started to apply it more often, and in Illinois, where Drew Peterson is being prosecuted, the legislature there said, hey, now that the Supreme Court of the United States has reminded us of this forfeiture rule, we're going to try to put it into codified statute law in Illinois because we'd like to use it against Drew Peterson. And, of course, Joel Brodsky, Peterson's lawyer, said, you can't do that. That's not fair. And, my client can't be held to this new law. The legislature can't just go about making new laws. And in a sense, Brodsky is correct that there's an ex post facto doctrine that says if a new law is created, you can't apply it retroactively to help a prosecution in a case where this wasn't the law before. It's just not fair. And that's a good argument, except that Joel Brodsky forgets this forfeiture by wrongdoing rule has been in place for over 300 years, since virtually the beginning of our legal system. So he's wrong that it's unfair or new. It's just that we haven't really used it often enough, and it sort of fell out of favor for a while. But this is a case where people started to look creatively at old doctrines. The Illinois prosecution certainly wanted to shore up a case that isn't that strong, and for good reason. Look, Drew Peterson is a cop. If anybody knows how to get away with murder, it's a cop.
Right.
So they know that they're dealing with someone who's very smart, and they're trying to be smart, too. Drew Peterson's smart, but now the prosecution is trying to be smart, too. And what they want to use, let me just add one more point here,
sure,
Dana. What they want to use is statements of Kathleen Savio indicating her awareness of Drew Peterson's behavior, threats, and so forth that he made, including, which is really important, her explicit concern that she might be killed in order to prevent her from testifying in her divorce case. And this is the key. If Drew Peterson killed Kathleen Savio to stop her from testifying in a divorce case, then he did wrongdoing that a court could and should conclude means that he forfeits his right to cross-examine her. And, of course, we know she's dead, so she's unavailable. But if he forfeited his right to cross-examine her because he killed her in order to prevent her from testifying, even though it's a different case, it's his divorce case, it doesn't matter. The law says that's inappropriate. We do not want criminals killing off witnesses to make them unavailable to testify. And we're so adamantly opposed to rewarding that kind of bad behavior, we're going to abandon the cross-examination rights that are embedded in the Constitution because we so don't want criminals killing off witnesses so they can walk away scot-free from serious crimes, or for that matter, from a legitimate judgment in a divorce case.
Most of my audience is well aware of Drew Peterson. In fact, when I've had Drew on the program, probably one of the highest rated programs that I've ever had, but yet the program that I had the most flack about. When you look at this, and of course we've talked about Kathleen Savio, when we look at Stacey Peterson, and just to update the audience a little bit about what she can say because she's not around either, how is that going to affect this case?
Right, that's the other category of hearsay that I'm certain also will and should come in, because it's not just Kathleen Savio's own words. It's Stacey Peterson who reportedly, now again, we don't know the details, but it's been reported that Stacey Peterson knew that Drew Peterson had killed Kathleen Savio. Reportedly, he acknowledged as much to Stacey, and that she can now testify to what she knew because she told people about that. Now, keep in mind, the Stacey Peterson statements are going to have a little bit of a different analysis because prosecution will have to prove that that Stacey was rendered unavailable. And by the way, you don't have to prove that Stacey was killed. Just prove that she's unavailable and that Drew Peterson caused her to become unavailable in part, not the only reason, but in part, to make sure that she was unavailable to testify either about something involving his abuse of her or something about the potential reinvestigation of Kathleen Savio's case. In other words, it's a different analysis. They have to focus on why would he have rendered Stacey Peterson unavailable. If they can show that it was wrongdoing, that he rendered her unavailable, at least one reason why he rendered her unavailable was to prevent her live testimony, then her statements, too, will be admitted against him, even though it's likely that she's dead. Now, on this point, what's interesting is Brodsky made the argument in his brief that that in order to get her statements in order to get either woman's statements in, he would have to show, the prosecution should have to show that the reason both women were rendered unavailable, whether killed or just rendered unavailable, was exclusively to make them unable to testify. And the law actually doesn't support Brodsky in that regard. It doesn't have to be the only reason they're unavailable. It just has to be one reason. So if he wanted to kill these women just because he was a thug and a killer and a murderer and a brute and abusive man, and it was icing on the cake that it would also render them unavailable to testify, then the statements will and should come in. Brodsky has tried to argue that it has to be the only reason they've been killed or rendered unavailable, and he's simply wrong about that, and I think that's an easy point for the prosecution to win.
Wendy Murphy's here, and we're talking Drew Peterson. You can find out more about this case that we're talking about by going to Wendy's blog at andjusticeforsome.blogspot.com. Turning the page a little bit here, Brodsky has gone before the courts asking for a change of venue, saying that all the publicity in this case has been unfair to his client, but you and I both know that a lot of the publicity was, in fact, Mr. Brodsky said on my show many times, it was a strategy of his, was started by he and his client. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. This wouldn't be the first defense attorney to complain about press in the context of a change of venue motion and then have it handed right back on a platter to him that he's the one responsible for causing it, so you can't complain. It's a similar kind of argument. You can't have it both ways. Generate press because you think it's strategically to your advantage and then say there's been too much attention. That actually happened in one recent case in Massachusetts where the defense complained there. It was the Clark Rockefeller case. Remember, he did. This is the man who kidnapped his own child, and it turned out he was a fraud, and all this craziness circled around the case. During his, right before his trial, he said he wanted a change of venue because there had been too much publicity, and the judge cited the multiple interviews he had done with one national television show after the next, and he did interviews with the media, the print media. And the judge basically said, you know, it takes a lot of chutzpah to complain about media when you cause it yourself. Now, there's also an argument that a defense attorney might just pick a terrible strategy, and the poor defendant doesn't understand that it's not good for him, that the defense attorney is really the one trying to grease the media, and, you know, and it's a selfish attorney and not the defendant who wants to do it. Those kind of cases are tougher, but I think in this case, we've all seen Drew Peterson without his lawyer ramping up the press and so forth. So, you know, you still want the guy to have a fair trial. As much as I'd like to wring his neck, I would hate to live in a country that couldn't provide even the worst among us with a fair trial. So I hope he does get a fair trial. But, you know, you can't just say there's been too much press. That's a per se unfair trial problem. It's going to violate my due process rights, because the law is also clear that publicity in and of itself is not inherently problematic. It's whether a jury pool then becomes unduly tainted. And, you know, the remedy is to ask the jurors who are likely to sit in judgment to answer questions. Have you read anything about this case? Of course, everyone on the planet would say yes, not just the people in a certain venue in Illinois. And the next question is the only one that matters. Despite what you've read, can you keep an open mind and pass judgment fairly on this man? And for the people who can honestly say yes to that, they're good jurors, and they should sit in judgment, and they will be selected. And that's the law. So he can complain about it all day long, but the bottom line is a high-profile case is not inherently unfair to any defendant, whether or not he causes the publicity.
Two big high-profile cases will both come to trial eventually, Wendy. One in Florida, the Kaylee and Casey Anthony case, and, of course, Peterson in Illinois. Last question for you. A big difference in what's been released to the public, obviously, in Florida. With the Anthony case, we see everything over and over and over again, tens of thousands of pages. In Illinois, we get little bits and pieces, different states, different rules. Talk about that and how it'll affect what we see.
Oh, you know, thank you for that question, actually, because I am on a tear to dispel the myth that we're getting any bit of the truth in the Casey Anthony case, and I hope your listeners will go to my piece on this issue at thedailybeast.com. You know, I write for the Daily Beast as well, and I have a very important piece there about how the Sunshine Law in Florida that everyone cites as the reason we're hearing gobs and gobs of information about Casey Anthony is just silliness. There are so many exceptions to the rules in the Florida, under the Florida Sunshine Law, so many exceptions that basically prevent the public from knowing anything about the real truth in that case. And I hope folks will, again, look at my piece and understand we're not getting the truth. We're getting a gross distortion of the truth in that case. And it's partly because one of the most important exceptions under Florida Sunshine Law is the one that says a judge can prevent public disclosure of information if it might be unfairly prejudicial to the defendant. In other words, Dana, all the really bad stuff that tells us the really gory truth about the Casey Anthony case, which I, in my opinion, likely has something to do with sex crimes and pornography. And, I mean, there are so many reasons to be suspicious about the real motive in that case and what really caused that child's death, that, you know, to think that we heard even a bit of the truth, I think, is preposterous.
Right.
On the other hand, you know, in Illinois, where they may have simply taken the position that a lot of the information would be harmful to the accused, and they have, you know, such a broad sweeping perspective on the issue that the judge has simply said, look, I'm not going to let anything out. Everybody knows a little bit, and that's it. Until trial, everything else is under seal. You know, there are states where judges can do that with this kind of broad sweeping judicial fiat, if you will. And then there's very little the press can do about it. I just want folks to understand that whether you have broad sweeping authority as a judge to just put a shadow over everything, as is true in Illinois, or you can nitpick through the stuff and distribute only that which is basically unenlightening. In the Casey Anthony case, we have to be very, very critical consumers of information and assume that no matter the jurisdiction, if there's something very damning to the accused in the file, we are likely not going to get access to it if it's a high-profile case. We might get nuggets. There might be a few leaks. The defense leaks like a sieve. The prosecution leaks sometimes, too. But let me end with this. We have to appreciate something very important. If the defendant wants to leak the entire file, they can. If the defense team wants to share stuff, leak stuff, call favorite reporters and give out gossip information, let's say the defense just wants to give out that which is good for them and they want to hide and not release that which is bad for them, the defense can do that with impunity because you can't really get the defendant in trouble if they violate a gag order. You know, you can't suppress evidence, for example, or render the defendant guilty as a punishment for them violating a gag order. Flip it over and look at what happens when the prosecution violates a gag order. They get in trouble. Motions to suppress evidence are filed all the time successfully to punish the prosecutor. You can punish the government when they violate a gag order. You can dismiss charges as punishment against the prosecution, against the state for violating a gag order. So the prosecution tends to obey gag orders better. The defense, because you can't punish them, because there's nothing you can do to the accused to punish him, you can't, in other words, prosecute him more harshly or give him a longer punishment or send him to jail faster or deny him a fair trial to punish him for the bad behavior of his lawyer. Because the sanctions on the defense side are virtually non-existent, when you do get leaks, especially in high-profile cases, they tend to be pro-defense, they tend to come from the defense side, and they tend to be very distorting, and it really is the prosecution that is more obedient. In other words, Dana, we're not getting the truly damning evidence, I think, in either of these cases.
Couldn't agree more. Wendy, thanks for spending time with us tonight.
You're welcome. Take care. Bye-bye.
Have a great weekend. Bye-bye. That's Wendy Murphy. You know her as a attorney, law professor, author, television analyst, and she has a new blog. Check it out. Go there, read it, make comments, and it's http://andjusticeforsome. So that's andjusticeforsome, all one word, .blogspot.com. It's an interesting blog, lots of stories there, comments and articles by Wendy. She writes articles and commentaries all over the place, but this looks like it's her blog, and of course that's the name of her book. Go out, check it out. Wendy's always a popular guest on the program here, and let her know what you think, and let her know that you heard her on this program. We're going to take a break here on Scared Monkeys Radio, and we're going to come back in a minute with violence expert and media expert Susan Murphy Milano, and we're going to talk about domestic violence, 15 things a woman should know, and that's very important. We'll be right back here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Okay, you'll know my next guest is the one of the co-hosts of the popular radio program on the internet on Blogspot Radio called Justice Interrupted. You'll know her as a violence expert, as an author, and a semi-regular guest on the program. We haven't had her on for a little while. Susan Murphy Milano is here, and she's got a very excellent article on her page titled 15 Things That a Battered Woman Needs, and we're going to spend some extra time with Susan tonight talking about the epidemic of domestic violence and how we can help victims of such. Hi, Susan. How are you?
Hi, Dana. Thank you.
Haven't had you on the show for a while. Welcome back. Let's talk about this and just get right at it because I think it's important. 15 things that a battered woman needs. Obviously, there's a list. Let's start at the beginning.
Validation. We don't believe, we don't support. Often we say, oh, he's not capable of that. I mean, Wendy Murphy was talking about earlier in hearsay law, and how could both these women have fallen for somebody like this, or these other people that have been with someone like that? It's not possible, possibly because of what he does for a living. It's a validation right then and there. You need to support them. They're not crazy. Believe them. Stop thinking that this couldn't happen just because you know the person. So validate what she's saying to you. Don't discount it. Support, comfort, respite, you know, that she is valuable, that she is worthwhile. A lot of times, you know, she's just a mother. She's just somebody who's behind closed doors. We can't see her. Maybe she's somebody that, you know, shows up in the classroom and takes care of the classroom once a month as part of something she does to help the school. And when she says something to someone, we don't support or comfort her. We don't ask her what's wrong. We don't ever say, what do you need, what do you want? These are things that are very important, and it's not anything that we really talk about. There's a case in California, Suzanne Annette Fowler, who was murdered 2 weeks ago. and she had done everything that she could to keep her abuser away. Part of the problem was that no one asked her what she needed, what she wanted. Instead, what she was doing was training her 8-year-old and 5-year-old daughters how to dial 911, and they witnessed this crime.
Mm.
And people didn't believe her. They didn't believe that he was that dangerous, even the police. So a lot of times we look at these women and say, well, it's not possible, and we just say, oh, no big deal. And this piece that I had put up on the blog was written 15 years ago,
right.
And technology has changed this as well. So when you ask somebody what they need, you know, you can do it over Skype. You can do it over the Internet.
Right.
You can pick up your cell phone. You can send someone an email. Again, we don't do these things. We don't keep in touch or contact anymore. With as much as technology has heightened our awareness and gotten us news and information at record rates, we don't do that with people's lives, if you think about it. We read the stories. We read the story about Jasmine Fiore, who was found in a suitcase.
Yeah.
How quickly did that story hit the Internet? Oh, my gosh, her fingers were cut, her teeth were taken out, and she was identified by her breast implants.
Yeah.
In the weeks and months to come, there's going to be a lot more information, and he's on the run. But how quickly did that story... Look at the amount of abuse someone like that endured
exactly.
All that time, and no one probably asked her, how can I help you?
And you know, Susan, I'm having some phone difficulties with you. I'm not sure if you're on a cordless or you can correct that for me, but it seems to be cutting in and out a little bit, but hopefully you can hear me. With that story in particular, and that kind of led me to my next question, you're a good host, you can read my mind here. When we see stories of domestic violence, quite often the stories that we see, the Chris Brown and the Rihannas, or this particular story, are the high-profile cases, but they're just such a minuscule amount, and they're treated differently by the media. So when it comes to the story itself and what someone needs, like this one is so tragic, stuffed in a suitcase, her teeth taken out and her fingers cut off and all that. That's gross. That's gruesome. But there's just a lot more to that, and it's happening every day across North America.
She called people. She told people. She let them know. She was trying to plan. There aren't a lot of services and things in place for women. And there's not a lot of places that they feel comfortable. They're embarrassed that this crime, and it's a crime, is being taken place against them. She was stalked, Jasmine Fiore. She was hounded by, you know, I think he was, I don't think anybody's certain whether it was still her husband,
right.
Or, you know, they had been, the marriage had been annulled. But he was jealous. He was after her.
When Susan Murphy Milano is here, and we're talking about domestic violence and 15 things that an article that she has on her blog site. It's an old article, but it's a very important one called 15 Things That a Battered Woman Needs. When you say that, and I've had violence experts, yourself, others, advocates on this program before, it just seems like you guys work so hard. You do so much work, but there's just not a lot of even government support out there for you. It seems like everyone wants to put blinders on or turn their back to domestic violence. Am I wrong?
No, you're not, Dana. And it's on this sheet it says, to be surrounded by people who get it. We don't get domestic violence as a crime as a society. We blame the woman for the person that she chose. We blame her for the mess that she's in. And yet, the court systems, the shelter systems in California, all of that funding is being cut. Governor Schwarzenegger is cutting all of that money. And there's no money for, you know, I think it was a $20 million budget.
Right.
Where are those women supposed to go? Are they going to cross the border? Are they going to have to go to Mexico? And yet, recently, I think just the other day, asylum for battered women who are immigrants is going to happen. Well, what about the women here in America, right at home?
Yeah. Well, how true is that? Susan Murphy Milano is here. Let's continue on with the list. What's next?
Next is to be able to participate in her community, a faith and of culture. That means, you know, to me, that means that the pastor of the church. I've done shows where we've had people on Justice Interrupted, and the woman went to 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 pastors
yeah.
who said, oh, my child, stay in the marriage. The Bible says do not get divorced. You can go get an annulment, but don't get divorced. Keep. So she's supposed to endure the abuse when it's a subject that is ill-educated. And, you know, in this country, we house, in the United States, the shelter budget for an animal, a dog or a cat, is 10 times greater than it is for homeless people or people who are abused. And 75% of all battered women in the homeless numbers, the total, in America, are battered women. So a huge part of our homeless population are battered women. And we don't see that. Also, when the woman gets, when she goes through the system, it says to be given accurate, updated, energetic, concrete information about the dynamics of domestic violence, the opportunities for her in the community, what's help, what's available, the actual practices that occur among police and the courts. Now, this is a big one. This is one of my pet peeves, because I spend time with someone. There's a difference with when I explain. It's like you going to court, Dana, and you got a ticket. I know that you're not going to give yourself one, but let's say that you're in the States, you get a ticket,
right.
And you don't know that if you wait a couple hours in the back of the courtroom, that then the judge will call those cases of the people that plead not guilty, whereas
right.
The people that plead guilty are all going to get a movie and a fine and maybe no moving violation on their license. And the judge will then take the cases of the not guilties, you know, one by one, and those that don't have lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing in this system. When a woman goes through the turnstile of the court building, she goes through another maze. The abuse was one part of it. The police response was another. And then the court system. She's thrown into a sea of other people in cubicles. And this is all across the country, where the court's officer or sometimes a state's attorney or an advocate takes her information. Let's take Kathleen Savio, because that's Drew Peterson's deceased wife, because that's kind of easy.
Sure.
Because I've seen the documents. So what she had to do was she went in among strangers. She was handed documents and said, fill them out and read the instructions. There are no instructions that come with abuse. I'm sorry. And then she's picked up, swooped to another cubicle, talks to a police officer from the court system, and then Kathleen Savio is taken then to the state's attorney, who spends probably 120 seconds, maybe less, says what he'll do, what he won't do, what do you want, and he takes the documents, looks at them, makes sure that she filled them out and signed them, goes before the judge. She sticks up her hand, swears on a Bible, the court, the bailiff's has her swear. He asks one or two questions. The judge slaps his gavel down whether it's granted or not. That's it. Now, she doesn't, no one tells her what to do with the order of protection, except that you're supposed to call the police if he violates it.
Right.
No one tells her the safety mechanisms. No one explains that she needs to know that if she's stalked, you know, he's going to follow her. Some things that she should do with her cell phone, perhaps take a picture with it. No one tells her these things that she needs to do, because the system is so overcrowded and so overburdened, so she's not given that accurate, updated, energetic, concrete information that she needs to survive future attacks. And that's for women across the country. Now these women have to be knowledgeable about GPS systems on their car, on their cell phones.
Right.
People aren't aware that on your cell phone you can be tracked. That you have to, I think it's on the iPhones, you should be able to turn off the mechanism. Again, you'd have to call your cell phone company, but get it turned off so that you're not tracked. Do you know that in the United States, if you go through a toll booth and you have one of these gadgets where it automatically pays for it because you put money in ahead of time, that if I'm the abuser, I can track what toll booth you went into by going into the account of this box and hitting a number, because there's serial numbers on the box, whether I'm the one that got the box for the toll booth or not, and I can track where you're going.
You know, it is amazing, and like you say, with technology today, the aspect of domestic violence is so much wider, not only domestic violence, but stalking, which usually leads to domestic violence or after domestic violence. It's a huge vicious circle, Susan, And when you look at this, and I've used the term many times, and I've even got it from you, is the term of re-victimization. And when the victim obviously is battered and then re-victimized through the system, there seems to be a way, or there has to be a way of correcting it. Is it all education, or do we need a complete revamp?
You need a complete revamp because the system has been broken for a long time. I don't think that when the system was created, and Wendy Murphy would probably agree with this, and so would Robin Sachs, is that there were things that have taken place, the upgrading of the abuse. The system was in place when women didn't come forward, when women didn't say, I need help, when police response was little to none, when we didn't have a 911 system. The courthouses were put into place and these laws were enacted without the 911. Now we have the 911. Now we have technology all over the place. So the system needs to be totally overhauled because they don't get it. I mean, it's not to say that you need a bunch of victims running the courts. That's not what this is about.
No.
The laws on the books, and I've said this many times, were enacted because people lost their lives. So when the, and I find this kind of ironic with Governor Schwarzenegger, is that he sat in the same office where his predecessors signed domestic violence acts and stalking acts into place. And that he took it away in one clean swoop with a pen. And that those pens before him were signed not with that ink in that pen, but with the blood of all those people who died. All those women and children and men who lost their lives because of somebody else's anger. And he just wipes it away. And so there's not an understanding. So what is in the state of California, as an example, and again, as an observation, what is the alternative? Do you teach female self-defense starting at the eighth grade? Do you teach and teach, you know, get rid of the home ec classes, and I don't even know if they have those anymore, but get rid of the fluff kind of classes, get rid of the art classes, and mandate that each child take a self-defense, an awareness class, a bullying class, you know, kind of put it all in together in a whole year of a curriculum. We don't have that. We see so many things happen. We see so many gruesome crimes that come to us, again, directly from the Internet or MSNBC or CNN. We see these right before their eyes. You see car chases, you know, with the helicopter, and they're following them through for a half hour. But you don't see what a battered woman endures. There was a couple of months ago in Connecticut, she was a Fox News Channel 61, Alice Moran, assignment editor. And she was texting as she was running around the house trying to get her two children safe. She was going through a divorce. Likely she didn't tell very many people. He shot her and then killed himself. This morning in California, in Murrays, California, a man killed his wife, Isabella Jarka, 40 years old, before insurance. He wanted to collect on the wife's insurance, and then he looked up on the Internet the quickest method of death and then how to remarry quickly.
Jeez.
This morning, he killed his wife.
Yeah.
We're pretty numb to this, and it continues, but there's a lack of understanding of women's lives and the role and the importance of this as a crime. You know, you can't give information in 30-second sound bites. It doesn't work that way. You see that we have all this political coverage, but we don't really have much coverage on crime. We don't. Shows like this bring it out. I mean, Wendy Murphy was eloquent in explaining the hearsay law, and even though it seems complex, that the outcome hopefully will be because it's been something that's been on the books for 300 years that nobody paid attention to. You know, it's that kind of thing. It's saying we need to put our resources into information. I'm a big proponent of self-defense. I've been going around the country with Annie Jacoby from the Women's Self-Defense, Female Self-Defense, and we've been doing 6 hours of training, a couple hours of roadmap of this is what you have to do and how you have to be safe. And then she's been teaching the self-defense of, you know, to teenagers and to young women, women of all ages, how you have to be safe. And it's also verbal self-defense, Dana.
Mm-hmm.
It's learning how to disarm the person during the abusive episode, to outsmart him, to be 10 steps ahead of him. We don't teach this. There isn't a lot of access for these women to advocacy, which is on this. High-quality, respectful, cultural, sensitive advocacy, the kind that makes you feel that you always have someone on your side. for somebody like me, there's only one of me. My phone rings almost 24 hours a day. And I can't reach everyone. And I can't help everyone as much as I'd like to or much as I think I'd like to. I do a half hour or an hour show now on Wednesdays on Blog Talk Radio just for women, women in abusive relationships. That includes women without custody. If you look at the case I was talking about earlier, actually all of these cases, the guy this morning, Kelly Lee Jackra, that killed his wife, Isabella, he took away the children. So that is maternal abuse, deprivation, power and control, and then it equals murder. So if these guys can't get there through the court system, what they do is they either take away the mother, or in the case of, in Illinois, Jack and Duncan Connolly, both 7 and 9 years old, there were 57 violations of the order of protection. And what happened was he took them on a visitation, he killed them, and then himself. All of these things are part of this, and the difficulty across the country is you can't cross the line between civil and criminal. A divorce attorney is there to paper shuffle and be your guidepost for your divorce and to protect your rights and hopefully to get a settlement that is equitable for you and or for your children. The domestic violence part of it comes into it. That's not her role. People were jumping up and down when Suzanne Annette Fowler was killed a couple weeks ago, and one of the relatives had called me and said, it's in the transcripts. Look at the transcripts. She didn't do this. She didn't do that. I said, that wasn't the lawyer's role.
No.
The lawyer's role was to do what's best for the civil. That's a civil matter. Criminal is where the police and the state's attorney or the prosecuting attorney or the DA, those represent the people, and that would mean those in violent situations because that's a crime. And we get confused as to what the lawyers can do. And then you have mental health experts who are not trained, who have biased opinions, who don't understand the complexity of violence in a relationship. And often, because the abuser comes off so lovely, so wonderful, that they don't see the violence. And in the end, you're seeing a lot of these cases where the woman is being killed or the children are being murdered because he got away with it, and he's going to make her pay. So he makes her pay by staying alive and killing the kids and then himself, or he makes the children pay by killing the mother. And we're seeing this. That, to me, is a more of an epidemic where the children are either being robbed of their mother or they're being robbed of their own lives.
Yeah, and you're right, and that's a big societal thing. People seem to sit back, Susan, and especially the older ones, the ones that, before even the baby boomers, or even the baby boomers were in that era, it was accepted somewhat that a husband would hit a wife. The wife was to be in the kitchen and to be behaving herself, and the husband gave her a little smack now and then. That's okay. That's what husbands do. That sort of nonsense is still out there. People just don't want to get involved. People don't want to say anything. Of course, the victims are scared. They don't know what to do. They think they deserved it. Of course, we could do a whole show just on the cycle of violence. Let's talk about that a little bit. That I guess it's even a culture of the older folks that are afraid of domestic violence or certainly don't know what to do about it.
Well, for the older folks, you're seeing a lot of women in their 50s and 60s who have put up with the abuse. Their children have gone. And they don't have, they're afraid that if they make a move or they say anything because they don't have the support system in place and their children have basically what I call opt out of the system, out of the divorce system where there's no more child support, or they feel that they can make it on their own. Many times they've built up this life and she's put up with it and she doesn't feel that she can go anywhere for help or that no one will believe her because she's got gray hair.
Yeah.
And so she's stigmatized automatically. What are you doing here? What do you need? When the police respond, in a few cases that I've actually witnessed, the what do you need? Why are you bothering us? So part of the response is, I just think it's culturally. I think that it's a learned behavior. It's something that always was. I mean, growing up, my own mother would put up with whatever my father did, because she just didn't have a choice.
Mm-hmm.
And had she lived, she would have seen the same thing. But as fate would have it, when my father had killed my mother, that was the end of what he wanted to do, was to take control. In a lot of these cases, you're seeing also when the battered women have become sickly, they've maybe had cancer, they have other ailments, and a lot of the abusers have, and it's not been talked about very much, they are killing them. They don't want to be bothered with them. We don't value life. We don't value a woman, and we still think that they're property and control. And we still don't know the signs and signals when you date somebody and you're on that first date and you feel wonderful. Dana, let's say that you asked me out and mm-hmm. you and I were going out and we're at the bar and you get upset that a man is sitting next to me when you come back from the using the restroom.
Right.
And I'm all happy about it. I'm like, oh, my gosh, he's jealous.
Yeah.
I go home, call my girlfriends and say, oh, Dana just loves me. And I'm so happy. And then you don't go away. You show up every day. You call. And you want to monopolize my time. We still think in this day and age, in 2009, that that still means wonderful. That still means that somebody likes us. We're so desperate, it seems, as a society, that we have to have somebody to love us, to be in our life. Otherwise, we're not worthy. So if we're not worthy, then that person that takes us then thinks that, well, you know, she's less than, but I know I can control her. I know she'll do what I want. And then over time, when they start to get abusive and they start to act out, the offender or the abuser, and they start to do things and rein the person in, what do you mean you're going out with your girlfriend? I'm sorry, you can't do that. We don't have enough information out there for these victims, and we don't have enough, like I said, training. We don't have enough things and tools for them to learn how to outfox him and to get away. They've chased a cycle of, if we talk about Isabel Fiore, who was found with a suitcase, she talked like chasing her tail. She called. She texted people.
Right.
She said, I have to get away. I have to get away. Well, why wasn't she able to just go to a place, doesn't have to be a prosecuting attorney, doesn't have to be a police department, go somewhere where maybe her manager, because she was a television star or a model, and I need help, take me. Well, maybe it's bad for your career, dear. We won't do this because the tabloids are getting it. Maybe something like that was said. We discount and minimize, perhaps, how dangerous her life was, how delicately it held, hung in the balance, and then all of a sudden she found herself in a suitcase.
Yeah, it's a sad...
Don't validate that. I mean, you're a police officer, Dana.
Yeah.
You see and hear these things all day long, and it's how you respond. It's how the prosecuting attorney responds. In the rural areas, there is not enough assistance. It takes the police or the fire trucks longer to get there. And again, legally, Dana, what rights does somebody have when that's still the person's home?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I know.
You can't go in.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And the domestic violence laws have tightened up somewhat across North America. We have something up here called an emergency intervention order, and there are other things. Protective orders sometimes aren't worth the paper that they're written on because they get violated as much as they get written. Just to remind the audience, Susan Murphy Milano is here. She's an author, violence expert, and we're talking about an article she has on her blog site called 15 Things That a Battered Woman Needs. When you look at that, and the education, and I think it's so important, the initial response. In fact, the initial response is probably the most important when a person who's been battered does come and ask for help. Am I wrong when I say that how the police respond, how the hospital responds, how whatever responds is so important, or that case and that person can go down the drain real fast?
On the list it says to be able to get to call for help and to get it.
Right.
When she calls the police, goes to court, tells her doctor, contacts child welfare, in other words, interacts with a system set up to enhance her safety. She needs a helpful response. She doesn't need to be punished for seeking help. We see this in cases of spousal rape all the time where there's domestic violence. She's not believed. She's pushed away. She's not given a rape kit. We see this when she does attempt to fill out the police report. But I think that the tactics of these individuals, of the abusers, have escalated so much that if she does call the police, if she does fill out paperwork for an order of protection, if she does tell anyone, it will be her last breath. I can't tell you how many times I've got a case right now. Excuse me. It's 6 months in to the divorce, and she won't drop it, the case, the action, the divorce action. He said to her, you're going to be sorry. Now, what we have done is put some things in place. She's got children. So if you're listening and if you have children, do not do anything to your home safety-wise. That means get an alarm system, put some extra locks on the windows or the doors when your children are there. Because it doesn't matter whether they're siding with you or you're their mommy's little girl or mommy's little boy. They're going to tell daddy that somebody was there and did something. When the truck comes and is going to put in an alarm system, let's say it's ADT, if you have a garage, have it roll in. Or give the company instructions to park around the block and have the person walk in without a uniform. Because somebody's going to tell. A neighbor's going to say, oh, Joe, you got an ADT system in when he's picking up the kids for visitation.
Yep.
You've now set off the alarm and bells and whistles that he knows that you've taken precautions. Don't sleep where you expect. When Suzanne Annette Fowler was killed, and I didn't get to the family quick enough. I had been dealing with a relative. I was waiting for her to call me to tell her to do some things. He knew where to go, so when he broke in the back door could have been more secured. It's an observation of what could have happened. He went directly to the bedroom because he knows the layout of the house. That's where he lived. Sleep someplace else. Take plywood. If you have basement windows and you don't have bars or you can't put anything on it, and cut in some grooves. I know you're not going to, you might think this is funny, but actually I do this. I take cutting shears, sometimes big, sometimes small, based on the size of the guy, the offender, based on the size of the window. And I take the handles of the shears, sometimes big cutting ones, and I put super glue at the bottom of the base in the grooves that I've cut out in the plywood, and I have them sticking right set up with the shears up sharp.
Good.
So that when he wants to crawl in the window, as this guy did,
he's going to have a surprise.
Recently, he was all cut up, and then he screamed foul.
Yeah.
But he was court ordered not to be in the house, so I just wanted to make sure he couldn't get in the house without having something happen to him until she was able to implement the alarm system. You have to think like the offenders. You think like the criminals, Dana, when you arrest them, when you go out and crack a case.
Yep.
It's the same thing. That's how we have to teach the women. So maybe I'll do something at Madison Square Garden. We'll get it on the World Wide Web, and everybody can watch it, and then they'll be safer for it.
Yeah, and that's so important. And, again, the article is 15 things that a battered woman needs. We could probably say 75 things and keep talking about it. Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert. Susan, just before I let you go, give a plug for your website.
My website is SusanMurphyMilano.com.
Simple as that. And, of course, you can hear Susan on Justice Interrupted on Blog Talk Radio. And you've got a new book coming out?
I do. It's called Time's Up, which talks about all the stuff that I'm talking about. And it'll be out at the end of the year.
Perfect. And time is up. Thanks, Susan.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. That's Susan Murphy Milano, and she's always a good guest. And it's an important topic, domestic violence. It's an epidemic across the world, and we have to do what we can to help educate the people. That's it. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. My name is Dan Pretzer. Hope you enjoyed the show. Make sure and check out our webpage at www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. There you can listen to live shows. You can pick up podcasts of past shows, leave comments, do whatever you like. And the creme de la creme of blogs, gee, I couldn't spit that out tonight, is scaredmonkeys.com for all your news, views, and information. And there's a real cool forum there. My name is Dana Pretzer. We'll see you again real soon here on Scared Monkeys Radio.
Been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.